Coversal's kickoff. This is Radio City Talk.
Chris Boardman is my guest this hour. Right, talked a little bit about the World Bikeathon. That's Sunday the 11th of June. Sunday the 11th of June. Bloodwise is the chosen charity, and they're close to the £1 million mark, so please help out. Google World Bikeathon, find out more information on how you can get involved. Right, we're close to the start of the cycling season as a whole. We were talking off air about the Tour de Yorkshire. It's become something of a phenomenon, and this is probably one of the first...
It was a surprise. It was a surprise success. I mean, the cycling season itself has kicked off quite a while ago, but in the UK, you know, this is when Joe Public actually gets to have a look. And it came off the back of the Tour de France visiting a few years ago, and it was enormous. I mean, the crowds were almost scarily large. And the Tour de France organisation were just shell-shocked. They'd never seen anything like it. We don't see it on the Tour de France, that level of crowd density. So Yorkshire went, brilliant, we're going to have the Tour de Yorkshire now. And sort of quietly, we were all sort of going, oh no, I hope it's just like a massive flop. It could be really embarrassing.
It's not gonna work.
And it was massive. It was absolutely massive. So it's almost by surprise, I'm sure not to the people who organise it, it's just become a thing, a big thing, and it's an enormous event. So it's on for 3 days, starts on Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And there's a woman's event that's equal to the blokes as well, which is brilliant. So it's good.
It's a bit of a cult event now then, is it?
Well, it is. And I mean, we were just talking about some events transcend sport, the sport itself. So even if you don't follow cycling, you'll know what the Tour de France is. Or if you don't do tennis, you know what Wimbledon is. And this Yorkshire event is heading in that direction. Even if people don't follow cycling, they're going to get more and more involved. They are getting more and more involved in the Tour of Yorkshire, engaged in watching it. There's lots of stuff going on around the races in the city centres as well.
So it becomes a bit of a party. So even if you can't get there, you can listen to Chris on the telly. It's on ITV, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Yeah. I didn't know whether I was allowed to say that. But,
oh, yeah, that's fine. It's got its own little platform there, hasn't it? Which is amazing. You see, in my head, I'm still thinking of the milk race. And, you know,
well, that was the problem for the milk race. I mean, there's a Tour of Britain now, which is quite big at the other end of the year. But that was its problem was its success, its sponsorship lag. So for a long time, for many years, it was always going to be called the milk race. So for the next sponsor, you know, it's like, well, there's nothing in that for me, is there? So it had to go quiet for a long time. And now the Tour of Britain stands on its own. And as its own brand, and that'll be right at the other end of the year.
Is that as successful as the Tour de Yorkshire in its own little way? Or?
The Tour de Yorkshire has just got going. It's only third year, I think. And I would say it's as big, if not bigger, than the Tour of Britain.
Right. And of course, the Tour de France is the one that everyone sort of focuses on, which comes around in
all
July.
July. Yeah,
What stage do you... Because you've ridden in the Tour de France. At what stage do you think, right, I'm going to make a real determined effort to be a huge success in the Tour de France?
It's just such an... It's the hardest sporting challenge in the world. I would challenge anybody, you know, to tell me differently. And, you know, I've said over the years, it's the only sporting event where you have to have a haircut in the middle, you know, which kind of sums it up. It's just ludicrous.
Take us through some of those peaks.
3 weeks,
challenges.
You know, you can be doing up to 8 hours a day with 7 mountain passes, and then you do it again the next day and the next day for 3 weeks. It's just insane, and that's why it engages people who aren't cyclists, because they can empathise with the challenge. And over that period of time, stories develop. They always do, and there's people you like, and there's people you don't like, and you want to see, oh, can they hang on tomorrow? And that's the beauty of sport, isn't it? It's a bit of a cliche, but it is, and because it's the stories and the ability to empathise with the people who were going through all this suffering.
What were the highs for you doing the Tour de France?
And generally
what were the
finishing.
Real lows?
Yeah. It ending was quite an exciting.
Don't tell
moment.
Me you started the day thinking I can't wait for this to finish.
Well, my speciality used to be winning the time trial that often kicked it off. And of course, it's the only stage in the entire race where you're guaranteed to take the leader's yellow jersey at the same time, because it's the first stage. So that was my job, in essence. It was 8 minutes. My salary depended on 8 minutes a year. So it was pretty high stress going into the tour. But if that first day went well, everything else was fantastic, you know, because you've already won, you know, before the race has even kicked off.
You've done your bit
for
the team.
Yeah. And there was a couple of occasions when I didn't win, and that was pretty horrible 3 weeks then.
You had 3 stage successes, though, is that right?
Yeah, I led the race 3 times,
Is that quite a special feeling?
Not wishing to sound really grumpy, I never look back. I'm just, I'm interested in whatever comes next. And I had to write, I wrote a book and finished it last year. And it was really hard to remember it all. And I had a brilliant, brutal editor in Gary Imlach. He wrote My Father, Another Working Class Sporting Hero, a book about his dad and football. He comes from Southport. And he was really brutal and really big on checking facts and details. And it was hard to get through because I just don't look back. And looking back, it just feels like I'm talking about somebody else's life in the abstract.
Gosh, and you've done so much. Is there a point in the Tour de France where, because you watch it on the telly and you think, oh, they're all dead comfortable. You know, it all looks pretty easy. They're elite athletes. Is there a point where you're thinking, I could just give up here? You know, when they're doing the mountain climbs.
That's what divides it up, and that's why it splits up and they don't all finish together every day. It's just who can suffer the most. Physiological differences, but often it's who can suffer the most, and that's when it starts to break apart the race. So it's, you know, that's why it's brutal. As far as suffering goes, you suffer more now if you ride a sportif event, and they do one every year, the Étape de Tour, which is the hardest stage of the tour, generally a week before, and 10,000 people do it. It's harder doing that, and I have done that once. I got quite drunk and agreed to do it. It was harder doing that than riding the tour because, as you said, you're a trained, fit athlete and you kind of reach your limit before you really, really suffer. Whereas if you go and ride something like a sportif, you're just suffering all day and it's. I found that much harder.
What's the first bit of the body to start going, Chris?
Probably your mind, like that. I think.
Is it? Is it just a mental challenge?
Yeah, well, it's just a niggling suffering and it's, as I mentioned before, it's who can put up with that the longest a lot of the time before you think, I've had enough. And that's what that kind of endurance sport is. You're pushing each other to that limit all the time and see who cracks first.
Do you enjoy the crowds? You know, you talked about the Tour de Yorkshire and you said we all saw those amazing pictures of almost like banks of people almost falling onto the roads where the cyclists are coming through. Do they help or are they a hindrance?
It's a difficult position for cycling because one of its beauties is you don't have to buy a ticket. Anybody can go and watch it and you can be arm's length from some of the greatest sportsmen and women in the world in those events. But they can get in the way. Not often, but sometimes it's so hard to race. I mean, Chris Froome famously ran last year because he hit a motorbike. He had a problem with his bike. Couldn't get a bike change because the cars couldn't get anywhere near him and he was losing time to rivals, so he ran up the hill. You know, it's the one moment that people remember from last year. It was incredible.
Would you have done that?
No, I'd have probably just sat on the side and cried. Had a little cry.
There's a certain determination of the man, isn't there? It sort of exposes an awful lot about Chris Froome that he felt the need to do that.
He's very polite and mild-mannered and dare I say, he's come across as quite boring in the last few years. But last year, when he does things like that, you show character and you show a bit of your personality, and that's what people want to see. And he did some attacking on downhills, which people don't do, you know. And it was really risky thing to do for a leader because you can get chased down and counterattacked and tactical stuff. But just the fact that he did it has made people empathise a lot more.
He's looking to create a bit of history, isn't he? Where does he rate? Chris Froome, if you're looking at...
I think he's going to quietly become one of the all-time greats. You know, in fact, really, already is, really.
It's a shame when you quietly become an all-time
great,
isn't it?
Yeah, but often with these things, I mean, in flipping sideways, you look at Steve Redgrave and people didn't know anything about rowing and nothing. And then suddenly he's up to like 5 gold medals. And goes, whoa, Steve Redgrave, he's brilliant. Yeah, well, he's been doing that for you know, over a decade now. And that's how sometimes these things work. And there's so many gold medalists and multi-gold medalists that you have to do something unbelievable to get your head above the pack, which is just pretty cool as a sporting nation to watch.
For those listening who don't know cycling, you know, intensely, who are the world superstars this year that are going to grab the spotlight?
Well, some of them are the old favourites of Valverde, Contador. You've got, obviously, Chris Froome. I think Geraint Thomas is about to emerge, Welshman Geraint Thomas, who's got the most phenomenal form right now. And looking at him, he's about to ride the Giro d'Italia. So that would be his primary goal ahead of the Tour de France, which I think is almost a shame because he's the person that everybody's wanted to see win. So there's a few. It's a good time for new names, actually. To be coming through, which is why I mention him. But the likes of Chris Froome is probably still the favourite.
Radio City Talk Breakfast. The kickoff with Steve Hothersall. Radio City Talk.
British cycling and where it currently is at. It's been dragged through the mud repeatedly over the course of 12 months. There's an independent report due out into the climate and culture in British cycling's world-class programme. Now, there's various elements that have sort of stained British cycling over the past 12 months. Are any of them worse than the others, Chris?
I think we've got a lack of proportionality, and it's been frustrating to watch that you've got several individuals who've come out and said, this is the experience I've had, and it's made massive headlines. And that's not unreasonable that this is the experience they've had. But there was, I mean, I worked there for a decade, and that's not the place I recognise at all.
It was so certainly your reference is Jess Varnish, isn't it?
Well, there's Jess Varnish, there's Vicky Pendleton, there's Nicole Cook, and they had that experience. Mm. But it's been incredibly narrow focus, because I think if you step back and go, hang on a minute, we've had the most successful three Olympic Games ever by any Olympic team, never mind the sport, any Olympic team. I mean, British cycling was, I think in Beijing, was ninth in the medal table in a country as its own right. More than half the medals were female. How bad is that really? You know, and people were fighting to get in. No one was fighting to get out. So you're thinking, it can't have been that bad. Yeah, every business has issues and you need to address them. No problem with that. But there was no counter voice. You know, there was no counter voice. I didn't hear anybody stand up and say, hang on, this has been incredibly successful and we're doing really well, and it's just not that bad. And I think a lot of people didn't stand up because there was a lot of sensationalist journalism about. And if I, for example, stood up in the last, it sort of calmed down now, in the last year and said what I've just said, there would be a headline that says Boardman backs old guard. And so you think, well, do you know what? I just don't need that, so I'm not going to. So all the people with a positive thing to say, I've just kept their heads down. And that's really sad, because it's created a picture of a place that's certainly not one that I recognise when I was there.
Yeah, I think you're right in saying there is a lot of sensationalism. This culture of fear, if you like. I've seen that in inverted commas an awful
culture
lot.
Culture of fear, I mean, come on.
Bullying. These are words that have been used attached to it.
And I think what perhaps has been missing and has been identified is there was not a proper mechanism for an athlete to go and say, I've got a grievance and I want to be taken seriously, and you go somewhere and it's dealt with. So there was certainly structure missing, because it grew so fast. I mean, I can remember Sir Dave Brailsford turning up in a little van at British Cycling 2004, I think I was involved at the start, and it just got bigger and bigger. In 2008, it just quadrupled in size. It was massive. So what was a group of passionate people making it work suddenly became a huge business, and a lot of stuff was left behind, and I think a lot of the checks and balances were. And those things were needed. But culture of fear, I think, is proper sensationalism, yeah.
There seems to have been this full overhaul. There's a new chairman in place, new chief executive, performance director in British Cycling. There's a 39-point action plan.
Yeah.
Was it in danger of shooting itself in the foot? Or was it in danger of being shot by the press?
Well, being shot by the press. But I think it's just the balance, I thought, was really sad, that you've missed all the good stuff that's happened has just been trashed, and it's been talked about like this massive failure and it's awful. And clearly it wasn't. It just wasn't that, and nobody was standing up for it. I know Sparky really well, and he is he'll be a fantastic performance director. He's perfect for that group. He's strong, he listens first, very balanced, but he will tell you the truth. He will stand up for the organisation. I don't know the incoming CEO, Jonathan Browning, the chairman. I know him reasonably good, and they've got a good group of people there. And I think that's exactly what this business, and that's what it is now, a business, that's exactly what this business needs.
How big have some of those successes been that you mentioned, the domination of the Olympics in terms of cycling? And
oddly, it's brilliant for us watching the Olympics. It's not particularly good for the sport, because when it becomes so one-sided for three Olympic Games, then people start thinking, well, why should we invest in this? And so the sport as a whole might contract. But I think what I've just seen, I've just been at the World Track Championships in Hong Kong, and the medals were really well spread around, really well spread around. Australia came out on top, and Britain did well, but not ridiculously, and I think that's good for the health of the sport. So,
and why is that? Is Britain dipping? Is there...
Always does post Olympic Games.
Right,
it always does. I mean, a cycle probably in any sport. Olympic Games. Those who are successful have lots of distractions and other things going on, and they lose a little bit of the hunger. You need a good kicking to get your hunger back. And then the next year is the people who were seconds and thirds and almost there are still like desperate to get their results. They're the ones who tend to win out. So it's like a 4-year cycle with performance. We've seen it now enough with the British team that we're not worried about it, you know. And then people start to panic and 2 years before the Olympic Games and then they'll come good again.
I was shocked actually when I went online before and saw they're already talking about Tokyo in 2020. But the story sort of revolved around Laura Kenny being named in the GB squad, Laura and her husband.
Yeah.
But then it was going on to talk about how squad numbers had dropped.
Yeah.
So from 110 to 87 because of a £4 million cut in funding. Well, where's the cut in funding for British cycling come from, or why indeed has it been imposed?
I don't know, is the answer. I'm not involved now. I'm quite quite happy about that. But I watch, same as you do as a spectator, every corner of the UK has got to be touched by the financial pressures that we're under now. Sport's no different, and squad sizes are going to shrink. And there's all, I mean, people have mentioned, again, I think maybe scrabbling for a headline, that there's a couple of top riders, national champion and Alex Dowsett, you know, are not on the men's road team. Well, they are if they're good enough, they get selected, and they're on pro teams, you pay them a massive salary, so, you know, don't worry too much. So I think it's in pretty good shape, to be honest.
For Laura and Jason Kenny, it's interesting. You said to me before, you haven't touched the bike much recently. It's saying here, Jason hasn't much since his success. He literally stepped away from riding the bike.
He's a lovely, quiet guy. And this, he's never sought out the limelight. In fact, actively moved away from it. And it's they're a perfect story, I think, of opposites attract as well. She's very effervescent and a strong character. And he's very, very quiet. And yeah, having a child now. So they're doing the things that normal people do and taking stock, really. And I think that's reasonable. And I don't think it's unreasonable that British Cycling just says, OK, well, we'll give you a bit of time. We've done it before. Give you a bit of time to think about it. You know, you're still an incredible investment if you choose that you want to do it. But that'll be a finite amount of time before he has to make a choice if he wants to carry on or not.
Is it like most sports, like boxing, where it is the drug, it's the appeal that you can't quite give up if you've achieved what, for example, these two have achieved, 10 Olympic titles between them.
Yeah.
Is it a case of you just have to go for the next Olympics regardless?
Well, it's one of those lovely problems, but it's a serious issue for very successful people, I guess, in any walk, but particularly in sport, is that what do you do next? You know, you will never get the massive highs. And I remember it. And the one thing that surprised me, I was really looking forward to getting away from the pressure of having to perform and, you know, as I mentioned earlier, all your salary depending on just a few moments. It's when it works out, it's the most intense and fantastic experience, but it can flip the other way. And I was looking forward to getting away from that. And what I wasn't ready for is bland is too strong a word, but there's no massive lows, but there's no massive highs either. So life becomes quite different. And I think you've got to say it out loud, the word retirement, to try it on, to truly believe it and think, right, how do I feel about that? And then you make a choice whether you're going to carry on or not. I thought about it and thought, yeah, that feels pretty good. I've never regretted it, and I was very lucky to get to finish content. So hopefully he'll either do that or decide, you know what, no, I've really had a break, mental break, and I'm ready for some more.
And what do you mean by no massive highs then?
Well, as I say, but you put all your eggs in that one basket, that one instant.
Yeah.
And if it comes off, you know, it's a fantastic experience, you know, huge high. But if it doesn't come off, you know, you go the other direction, and we don't write stories in the press about those most of the time. You see the person with the hands in the air and tears in their eye, and isn't it great? But the cost of that is all the rest of the field didn't do that. And so you've got to be able to deal with the disappointment. I've always said being a successful sports person is your resilience to be able to deal with massive disappointment. And you just get to the point where you, without wishing to get too philosophical, your despair outweighs your elation, then it's time to stop.
And is there something different between being an Olympian or an amateur athlete and a paid professional athlete? You referred to the paycheck.
Probably risk in that, you know, when I was... So I didn't even go back to school to pick up exam results, and I invested everything in sport. And I was lucky that it came off, but it could quite easily have not come off. And then I'm just 10, 15 years behind everybody else who's gone on an academic route or set up a career or both. And then I've got to catch up. So it's a very high risk thing to do, sport. You know, it is very much a labour of love in every sense. And so you don't do it for advancement. And if it doesn't come off, which it doesn't for most, you have to pay a price later on.
But you did refer to the paycheck, didn't you? The Tour de France
well,
paycheck.
Well, yeah, as a pro athlete, that's exactly what it is. You know, I think it's a lovely reward that comes. I mean, I wanted to see how good I could be, and I kept stepping forward and moving forward. Yeah. So what's the next thing? The biggest time trial in the world, you know, the first stage of the Tour de France. Well, let's try and do that. And then that came off, and then suddenly people are giving you money to do things. Because when I won the Olympics in 92, we had absolutely nothing. You know, we lived in a little terrace house. We had nothing. My wife spent everything we had in the bank in buying a ticket to go out and watch, which she didn't tell me. Bought a ticket off a tout outside to come in and watch. And then a week later, we were getting £3,000, which when you've got no money is just unbelievable amount of cash. £3,000 to just turn up somewhere for an hour. And we just couldn't believe it. So, you know, if it comes off, great. But if it hadn't worked out at that Olympic Games, then I'd have been an unemployed carpenter looking for work.
Didn't do too badly. And it'll be on your TVs all summer now.
You can still make quite a nice cabinet.
Right, so the Tour de Yorkshire, what else are you commentating on this summer?
Oh, I do about 2 months of media work each year, which is enough for me. So I do a month of stuff for the BBC. There'll be the Road Worlds at the end of the year, Tour of Yorkshire for ITV, and then Tour de France for ITV, which is an annual staple, which is always a fun trip. We squabble and fight our way around France and watch some fantastic bike racing.
That's enough for you. And then you're back mowing the lawn.
Yeah.
But you've got to get in training for Sunday the 11th of June, the Wirral Bikeathon. So please do get involved. Chris is going to be there. 14 or 28 miles is the ride. It's all in aid of Bloodwise, and they're so close to the £1 million targets. The Wirral Bikeathon, supported by Radio City and Radio City Talk, and loads more information online. Just type in Wirral Bikeathon in Google.
The Kickoff with Steve Hothersall on Radio City Talk.